He leaned forward over the table, lowered his voice.
Don't you want to know for sure what happened back then, Allison? And why it did?
Allison now. The hotel turned out to be just around the corner from the cafe, so close that the 30-second journey there in Malone's car left me embarrassed. In fact, part of that red brick apartment complex actually faced onto the canal. He turned to me as we pulled up outside the main entrance, looking like he was ready to play another episode of Malone Convinces Allison to Stay and Help. I have your number, I said quickly, and got out of the car. I was too tired to think, and grateful for it. I made my way to my room on autopilot, but when I got there, what I saw coldly snapped me back awake. The door was open. I stopped with my plastic key card suspended in mid-air, ready to swipe, staring at the bright inch or so of daylight wedged between the edge of the door and the frame. The Do Not Disturb sign I'd left on the handle was still there. Housekeeping shouldn't have been inside. So why was it open? I doubted it had been my doing. I was sure when I'd left the room earlier, I'd pulled the door shut behind me and waited for the confirmation click. I looked up and down the hall. There was no one in it but me. I strained to listen, to see if I could detect any movement or noise coming from within the room. Nothing. I called out a hello, but got no response. When I pressed against the wood, once, gently, the door swung back, slowly revealing my unmade bed and my small suitcase sitting on top of it, the lid down but not zipped, the legs of a pair of sweatpants spilling out over the side. Definitely not housekeeping then. I took a step forward, onto the threshold, called out, hello, again. Still nothing. I thought of something then. The electronic door lock. Years ago, I'd had to attend a SunCam conference in London, which involved staying 3 nights in a soulless airport chain hotel that seemed to have been built at the end of the main runway, going by the jet engine roar outside. The real treat of the place was how every time I returned to my room and slid my keycard into the lock, the door refused to open for at least the first 3 or 4 attempts. Same thing was happening to my colleagues. I'd mentioned this to the front desk on checkout and got a weary, "Yeah, it's the batteries," in response. Apparently there were batteries in these door locks, that's how they worked, and these batteries lasted a certain length of time, and in this hotel, they'd all been installed at the same time, during a renovation a few years back, and were now all dying en masse. Was that what had happened here? I slid my keycard through the lock. Nothing. No click, no indicator light glowing red or green. I didn't want to chance closing the door and repeating it from the outside, in case I couldn't get back in. But I was willing to believe the lock was dead. Could that account for the door being open, though? If the battery died in the electronic part, did the actual door lock, the mechanical bit, just release? I decided I was tired enough to decide that it did. I went into the room, shutting the door behind me with a loud bang. I stopped first at the bathroom, throwing its door open, flicking on the lights. Back into the main room, pulling open the wardrobe doors, flipping back the top of the suitcase, appraising the arrangement of pillows and sheets on the bed. I unzipped the compartment on the underside of the lid of my case and slid my hand back and forth inside it until they met my passport. Everything seemed to be just as I'd left it, except for the door itself. I thought I should ring the front desk about my dead door lock, but if I did, they'd send someone up to fix it, and that would delay my shower and sleep. I'd do it later. Afterward, not now. I closed the curtains, kicked off my shoes, and wandered back into the bathroom. I looked at the bath, considering it, but I was so tired I was sure I'd fall asleep in there. Instead, I pulled off my clothes and got into the shower. I stayed in the spray until my fingertips started to prune, and the skin on my chest was bright red from the heat. There was a luxurious toweling robe hanging on the back of the bathroom door. I wrapped it around myself as tight as it would go. Thoughts of Will. Memories. Images of him from today, arguments for and against Malone's theory, from the voice in my head, were just beneath the surface, all clamouring to burst through. I pushed them down. I knew how to. I'd gotten good at it over the years. And if I didn't, I knew Liz would come next. I filled the tiny kettle at the bathroom sink, and then back out in the main room, set it to boil. There were Barry's tea bags in the little amenities tray. Even though I'd had at least one cup of Cork's own brew every day of my adolescence, I didn't think I'd tasted it once in the last 10 years. I carried the cup back to the bed, setting it down on the nightstand before climbing under the covers, and then promptly fell asleep before I could take a single sip. I dreamed I was back at St. John's, only with Sal instead of Liz. Will was coming to meet us. Old Will. My Will. And I was so excited that I was finally getting to introduce Sal to him, to tell her about him, that when the ringing of a phone pulled me back to the surface, I felt disappointed. I didn't know how long I'd been out, but I was groggy enough to know that it had been a while. Hours, maybe. My hair was damp now more than wet, and the light in the room seemed different. I swapped out my cold, wet pillow for a dry one before I reached over to pick up the phone beside the bed, putting the receiver to my ear as I lay back down. Hello? Silence on the line. Hello? I said again. Beep, beep, beep. Whoever it was had hung up. Wrong number, probably. A single incorrect digit would get you through to the wrong hotel room. The LCD display on the phone was showing the time. 3:30 p.m. I'd been asleep for more than 3 hours. I went to the window and scanned the view I had of the street outside. Nothing much had changed from earlier, except for a clouded sky and slightly more traffic. I looked across the water to scan the opposite bank. That's when I saw him. He was sitting on a bench by the water. The canal was between us, so his features were mostly indistinct to me. But he was definitely a he, wearing black tracksuit pants with a white stripe down the side and a bright red baseball cap. And it seemed to me he was looking up at my window, looking right at me. The phone rang again. I didn't say anything this time, just held the receiver at my ear and waited instead. Allison. It was Malone.
Oh, I said. Hi.
Were you sleeping?
No. Well, I was. I woke up before you called. There was noise on the line. Wherever Malone was calling from, there were a lot of voices in the background.
Everything okay? He asked.
I stifled a yawn. Yeah.
Allison, there's been a development.
What does that mean? Something's happened. What?
I'd rather tell you in person.
Why?
And I need to show Will something.
I rolled my eyes. You mean you need me to show Will something?
Yes.
What? Malone hesitated.
Really, I'd prefer not to talk about this over the phone. I can come to you.
We arranged to meet at the hotel in an hour's time. After I hung up, I went back to the window. The man on the bench was gone. Allison, then.
What?
Liz whispered from beside me.
The actual?
My mother's head snapped towards us, and Liz fell silent, mid-sentence.
I know it's small,
the estate agent said. He was wearing gold cufflinks in the shape of little keys and a pink pocket square, and his hair was so thick with gel that it looked to have hardened.
But look at it this way. You won't have far to travel to your first cup of coffee in the morning, will you?
He laughed heartily at his own joke.
That's certainly true, my mother muttered.
She glanced at the A4 page on which she'd printed a list of all the properties we'd booked appointments to view today. And this one was...
Only 800 a month.
The four of us were squeezed into a room smaller than my bedroom at home. But while my room had a bed, a wardrobe, and a desk, this had a bed, a two-cupboard-wide kitchenette, a washing machine, a wardrobe, a dining table for two, and, in the far corner, a tiny bathroom whose entire floor was also the shower tray, and which had a plastic accordion-style door, because there just wasn't any room left for the arc of a normal door to swing out or in. Everything looked grimy or damp, or both, and nothing matched. If I'd been told every item had been saved from a dumpster, I wouldn't have blinked. The journey to the room hadn't been anything to write home about either. It was one of 10 bedsits, carved out of a 3-story Georgian terrace house that seemed to be rotting from the outside in. As a test, I put one hand on the cold, damp mattress of the single bed. I reached out and touched the buttons on the microwave with the other. The crazy thing was, it wasn't the worst property we'd seen today, nor was it the cheapest. My mother pointed at us. "There's two of them, though." The agent didn't miss a beat. "We can swap the bed for bunks." Liz and I exchanged a glance. We already knew what our lives were going to be like in Dublin. We'd spent the last year talking of little else. This place, they wouldn't fit into it. Looking around, I wasn't even sure I'd risk bringing my laptop in here. I wasn't even sure I'd risk sleeping in here myself. With each viewing, our Dublin daydreams were increasingly just that. Dreams. The reality was devastating. If I had to live in a place like this, I wasn't sure I even wanted to go to college here. I might just stay in Cork. "Well," my mother said, "I think we've seen enough." As we walked back down the stairs, carpeted in an ugly pattern of brown and orange, Liz whispered to me, "I bet we'll see this place again. On the news in a few years' time. Bodies under the patio. Mark my words." My mother's phone rang, and after she'd answered it and listened for a few moments, she turned to us with a smile. "Your father's novenas must have worked, Ali. A letter arrived this morning. He got a room in Halls. Thank God for that." When Liz called home, she had one too. At the time, it felt like the best news either of us had ever got in our lives. We travelled by convoy to Dublin, each set of parents having to take a car, because our stuff, suitcases full of clothes, boxes of books, packages of brand new bed linen, wouldn't fit in one. St. John's offered the option of moving in on either the Friday or the Saturday ahead of Freshers' Week, with an action-packed schedule of orientation and welcome activities planned just for Hall's residents, all day Sunday. Liz and I opted to travel up Friday. We planned to swiftly dispose of our parents and then spend Saturday exploring our new college and the city beyond it. At that stage, Dublin to me consisted of O'Connell Street, the Spire, Grafton Street, shopping, and Temple Bar, tourists. I knew about Molly Malone and the Phoenix Park, and on a school trip once, we'd visited Leinster House and seen the Book of Kells in Trinity College. I knew about Stephen's Green, but to me it was a shopping centre, not a historic park. The first time I'd seen the canal was when Liz and I had come up on the train to attend St. John's Open Day back in November. Before then, I hadn't even known there was a canal. I was yet to find out there were actually two of them, the Grand on the south side of the city, the Royal on the north.
"This is a nice area," my father said as we drove parallel to the water, down Mespel Road, towards the St. John's campus.
My mother didn't share the sentiment.
"You better be careful," she said to me,
"walking along here at night. Look, there's no barrier there. You could easily fall in."
"Fall in?"
I rolled my eyes.
"Ma'am, seriously?"
"I am serious. I've seen you fall in our front door after a night out." There were 8 accommodation blocks for St. John's undergrads, modern glass and steel structures, dotted together in manicured grounds towards the south end of the campus. Although Liz and I ended up in different ones, they were side by side, Block A and Block B. We were greeted by student helpers in St. John's t-shirts, who checked us off lists and bestowed upon us our electronic keys. We let our fathers carry our stuff up into our new rooms, and our mothers make up our beds with new linen, something we probably wouldn't do in a few months' time, after a single gender studies module convinced us we knew more about the world than our parents had learned from decades of living in it. My mother also insisted on stuffing 3 bags of groceries into the fridge, while my father walked the whole apartment, flicking every switch and making me promise that I'd tell someone about the 2 dud light bulbs he discovered on his rounds.
I posed for pictures. Me and my new room. Me and my new kitchen. Me and Mam on my new couch. Waited while Mam had a little cry about her only child going off to college, as if this, after 18 years, was somehow coming as a complete surprise, and then I shooed them out as quickly as I could. As the door shut behind them and the apartment fell completely quiet and still, I felt a tremor of anxiety. I was all on my own now, in college, in Dublin. Thank God Liz was just next door. She came knocking not 10 minutes later, having rushed her parents off as well. I think they're going to get some dinner together, she said. On campus, my dad said. She rolled her eyes. Let's hide in here until they're gone. You hungry? I nodded at the fridge. Mam stocked that before she left, because, you know, they don't have any shops here at all, and there isn't a subsidized cafeteria less than 5 minutes' walk away, where we can eat 3 meals a day on the cheap. Liz rolled her eyes again. Let's see what we got. I went into my room to unpack more stuff, leaving the door open so I could chat with Liz while I did. Any sign of your roommate yet? I asked her. No, I hope it's someone normal, though. You know what I was thinking? We can ask one of them to swap. Is that allowed? I didn't want to start rule-breaking before classes had even begun. Oh, they won't know, Liz said dismissively. Yeah, I suppose. Well, we'll see. The truth was, I was secretly glad Liz and I had ended up in separate apartments. I wasn't at first, because it jarred so much with the idea of us at St. John's that I had replayed over and over in my head. And I was glad now that in this sea of strangeness, on this cliff edge of adventure, a familiar face was just next door. But in between, I'd found myself a little excited at the thought of there being some distance between us. Liz was my best friend, but she was also prettier, louder, and more popular. I wasn't quiet, but people seemed to think I was when she was around. I wasn't shy, but somehow I felt myself acting that way whenever I went to new places with her. So I thought it might be nice to have the chance to meet new people for myself, by myself, to not, for once, come as part of a package where I always seemed to be the bonus material, never the main feature. Ali, Liz called from the kitchen. Lunch is served. Well, late lunch. Very late lunch. She'd found the crockery and cutlery that came supplied and laid the table with it. From the food my mother had brought, she'd assembled delicious-looking ham and cheese baguettes. Also on offer were a bowl of chips, a tub of prepared mango chunks, and cans of Coke. Seeing the spread, I realized I was starving. We'd stopped for breakfast at motorway services that morning, but it was nearly 4 in the afternoon now. We got out my new laptop, set it on the end of the table, and put in a Lost DVD to entertain us while we ate. What do you want to do tonight? Liz asked. In Dublin? We live here now, I said. Can you believe it? And there's nobody to tell us what time to be home. So what's the plan? Liz gave me a look like she was about to say something unpopular. What? I asked. Just say it. You know what I really want to do? What? Even though this is our first night of freedom and all that. Go on. I want to get some greasy takeaway, bring it back here and watch more Lost. I looked at her for a beat, then started laughing. That's exactly what I want to do too, I admitted. I'm bloody exhausted. It's been way too much excitement for one day. We can be freshers tomorrow. And we will, Liz said. We'll fresher hard. But tonight, we veg. Veg and Lost. That could be a crime-fighting duo. Liz yawned. I'm so glad we're on the same page here. Let's maybe not tell anyone about this, though. I was going to suggest the same thing to you. If anyone asks, we went clubbing. And the sun was up by the time we got in. So that's what we did. We spent our first night as students in the Big Smoke, carrying greasy cartons of Chinese food back to my new apartment, and watching Lost on a laptop while sat on my scratchy little couch. With our whole lives ahead of us, our new lives, waiting for us,
postponed just until the following morning. That night was like an airlock, a safe passage between the home I shared with my parents in Cork and apartment A3 in St. John's Halls. I remember thinking, this is it. This is what being happy feels like. And it's only going to get better from here. I was awake with the dawn the next morning, energized by the novelty of waking up in a new place, and terrified that my new roommate would choose to arrive at 8 a.m. on a Saturday and meet me for the first time just as I fell out of bed. She actually arrived just after 9. Claire from Sligo, who was going to be studying international law, and after introductions I stayed out of the way, while a guy who I guessed was her boyfriend helped her move her stuff in. He's going to Trinity, she explained after he'd left. He's in his second year there. He's not back until next week, so he's driving back up home now. She stuck her hands in her pockets, rocked on her heels. I don't know, like, anyone here. Well, you know me now, I said, and my friend Liz is in the block next door, so soon you'll know her too. I hadn't heard from Liz yet this morning. I thought about sending her a text, but then, emboldened by the fact that I was here, meeting new people without her, I suggested to Claire that we go for a stroll around campus. Liz was probably still sleeping anyway. She wasn't a morning person. My mother filled the fridge before she left, I said, but didn't leave any tea or coffee. Are you up for going to find a cafe somewhere? But there was nothing, seemingly, happening on campus at this hour on the Saturday before Freshers Week. Aside from a few more early move-ins, the place felt like a ghost town. The coffee kiosk beside the library building was closed. We wandered out onto the expensive residences of Haddington Road, walked past its imposing church in the direction of Baggot Street. I logged all the street names, labelling the map I was building in my head. I spotted an adorable little coffee shop with a white picket fence resting uneasily on the paving slabs on the footpath outside. How about there? I said to Claire. She nodded. Sure. We'd only been in there 5 minutes when Liz sent a text asking if I was up yet. I told her where I was, and she said she should come meet us. The door to the cafe was behind Claire's back, so I saw Liz before she did, and I knew right away that she was pissed off. She didn't even look at me as she approached the table. She was looking to her left, out the windows of the cafe, and when she plopped down beside me, all I got was a cold, "Hey." "Hey," I said, "did you find us okay?" I didn't get a response to this. Liz just picked up the menu and started studying it intensely. I didn't want to wake you, I added lamely. I knew why she was mad. If I'd woken up and discovered that Liz was already off having coffee with her new roommate and had gone without asking me to join them, I'd have been upset too. The difference is, I wouldn't have let her know that. I wouldn't have thrown a tantrum or got odd with her. It wasn't in me. I couldn't do it. But Liz, she could put on a bad humor with the flick of a switch. Claire probably didn't notice because Liz launched the full charm offensive on her. She asked her millions of questions and cooed over the pictures of her boyfriend that Claire had on her phone. They were soon laughing and joking like old pals, and I could see the little sliver of advantage I'd had with Claire. The half hour I'd been able to bank with her before Liz showed up, steadily diminishing. I talked to Claire, Liz talked to Claire, and Claire talked to us. And I hoped we all did that enough for Claire not to notice that Liz barely acknowledged me at all. She didn't even speak directly to me until we were back on campus and parting ways. Liz had said she'd unpacking to do, and I'd lied and said I did as well. Then she turned to me and said, "I don't think I'll be going out tonight." We'd made plans to make the acquaintance of the campus bar, a place nicknamed the Hattie. I knew what my next line in the scene was. We'd rehearsed it plenty. I was supposed to try to coax her out, giving her an opportunity to decline again. Or maybe I was supposed to say, "Fine, I won't either," and commit myself to staying in with her, to keep her company while she sulked. But I couldn't bring myself to. So instead, I told Liz to call me if she changed her mind. When we got back upstairs, Claire asked me how well I knew Liz. "Very well," I said. "We've known each other since the first day of primary school. So for like, what, 13 years now?"
Are you two good friends, then?
I nodded.
Best friends?
Oh.
Claire was frowning, confused. There was a defense of Liz on my tongue.
The way she was this morning. She's not always like that. That's not what she's really like.
But then I thought, let Liz make her own first impressions. That night, Claire and I went to the Hattie. I left my phone at home. The next morning, Liz was all smiles again. She'd knocked on the door of our apartment early in the morning and had a cup of bad instant coffee with Claire and me. She didn't ask me how I'd spent the previous evening, and I didn't volunteer any information. It was as if yesterday had just disappeared into the past, swallowed up like a stone by the sea, leaving the surface smooth and unbroken again. She did have news, though. Her roommate had arrived. Liz had Claire and I captivated as she dramatically doled out little drops of the story. She'd woken up this morning to discover a suitcase sitting in the living room, even though she hadn't heard anyone come in. Next thing, the door to the other bedroom opens, and out walks this girl, dressed head to toe in black and with piercings in her cheeks. Liz showed us exactly where more than once. The girl picks up the suitcase, hauls it into her room, and closes the door again without saying as much as a word to Liz. "So I'm living with a psycho," she declared. "You two might have to let me move in here." I knew Liz was joking, but my laugh was to make sure that Claire did too. A shadow of something had crossed the girl's face at the suggestion. St. John's Halls had an entertainment committee, made up of and voted for by student residents, and the last responsibility of the outgoing one was to organize the orientation program for the incoming freshers. Most everybody had arrived by now, and a huge tent had been set up on the lawn to house us all. We sat through some boring presentations on things like health and safety, and budgeting for food, and then after that, outside, the fun began. There were ice-breaking games, challenges, quizzes, speed-friendling, and a five-a-side football game. A barbecue was laid on for lunch. We were all given stickers to write our names and courses on, and encouraged to wander around striking up conversations with anyone and everyone we could. Normally, this would have been the kind of thing that would have made me want to curl up in a corner in a ball of dread and shame. I considered myself sociable, but I wasn't exactly the stranger whisperer. Liz usually paved a path for me. But there was a leveling aspect to this day that somehow made things easier. After all, we were all new. We were all first years. We were all wandering around, blinking in the light of this new world, away from friends and family, very excited, but also a little unsure. We started collecting people. We met Lauren, who had never met Claire, but it turned out they shared a mutual friend they could bond over. She was studying art history and lived in the apartment next to Liz. We met Ray, an American who turned down the chance to go to Harvard for a chance to come to Dublin. We all thought he was bonkers and told him so, and whose smooth TV accent we couldn't get enough of. We met Daisy, a fellow English literature student, who was dressed like she'd been in a teleportation experiment gone slightly wrong. All her clothes seemed to be patchworks of other bits of things, pieces of material jaggedly and inexpertly sewn together in some sort of Frankenstein's monster-style couture. She introduced herself by saying she did PR for Essence, which I think we were supposed to know was a club in town, and that she could get us on the guest list for tonight if we wanted. Someone said, "Let's go," and one by one the rest of us fell in. I felt like I was being swept away on a wave, but I wasn't entirely unhappy about it. We split to go back to our rooms and change, with the plan to reconvene under the arch at the entrance in an hour's time. Liz came to our place to get ready. Claire produced a bottle of Smirnoff and made us all vodka and cokes. "I brought something for you," Liz said to me. She reached into the bag of clothes she'd brought with her and pulled out a gorgeous silk shirt. It was silver with a spray of green and purple flowers up one side, and it wrapped around, tying with a large purple ribbon at one side. It was absolutely gorgeous. I owned nothing like it. I'd been planning to head out in jeans and a plain black top. "Oh, Liz," I said, "that's beautiful." "It's a bit big on me," she said. "Do you want to try it? I'll probably just dump it in the charity shop otherwise." "A bit big on me," I ignored the dig because there was no way I wasn't wearing this top, even though it was a little big on me too.
No, Liz said, adjusting it for me. It fits great.
I put on a white string vest to counteract the way it gaped a bit at the front, and pulled the ribbon as tight as I could to stop the extra material from bunching too much around my waist.
That looks amazing on you, Liz declared when I was done. You have to wear it out tonight.
I turned in front of the mirrored wardrobe door. I will. I might never take this off. It turned out, of course, that by did PR for, Daisy meant stood on the street and handed out leaflets. And that by get you on the guest list, she meant pay €20 and win the bouncer's approval and yeah, okay, we'll let you in. But the club played good music, we saw plenty of faces from halls, and a good time was had by all. Until just after midnight, when I felt someone tug at the ribbon around my waist, and then the entire shirt started to loosen and fall. Some drunken idiot behind me had untied the knot. When I turned around to confront him, he reached out his hands and pulled me in, and suddenly his vile breath was all I could smell. I tried to wriggle out of his arms, but he just pulled me tighter. I was about to bring my knee up as hard as I could between his legs when I felt him move away and then realized he'd already been pulled away, and now this other guy was standing between the two of us, squaring up to him, staring him down.
"What are you doing to my girlfriend?"
he demanded. I looked up at him. Up, because he was at least a foot taller than me. He had unruly blonde hair left natural, messy with no gel, and his skin was tanned, like he'd just come back from the beach. He was wearing a bright white t-shirt which only accentuated this, especially in the dim lighting of the club. I could smell him, the scent of some cologne or deodorant or something, musky and masculine. Not the Lynx Africa the spotty boys at home like to indiscriminately douse themselves in. The drunk idiot was looking him up and down.
Girlfriend.
This must have sounded like a challenge, because my defender reached out and took my hand.
Yeah, he said, girlfriend. So you better apologize to her and then you better piss off.
The drunk idiot hesitated for a second, then did as he was told. Thanks a lot, I said after he staggered away. I was just about to knee him in the balls.
Oh no, were you? The guy turned to look over his shoulder. Should I go get him? I can hold him in place for you.
Nah, I said, it's all right.
Is your shirt okay?
I looked down at it. It will be when I tie it up again. I looked back up at him. Which I will do when you let go of my hand.
You can't do it with one.
No.
You're not even going to try.
I smiled. Can I have my hand back, please? He let it go. I'm Allison, by the way.
I'm Will.
Allison, now. Malone said he'd be an hour, but he took closer to three. He called to say he'd been held up at the station and would be a little bit late, and then again to say he'd be a lot later than that. I hadn't booked a return flight, and neither Shaw nor Malone had said anything about one, although before we'd left the Netherlands, they'd made vague promises about my being back in time for work on Monday morning. Earlier, I checked the Aer Lingus website and found one seat left on that evening's flight to Amsterdam, mine for just over half a month's rent. I wasn't sure I could book it and send the bill to Angarda Síochána, so I waited. By the time Malone called to say he was parked outside, the seat was sold. I wondered if that had been his strategy all along, and how much longer, realistically, I was going to stay here. It wasn't the only strategic move I suspected him of. I hadn't actually agreed to go see Will again, but Malone was waiting for me in his car with the engine running. As soon as I sat in, he took off. When I asked what the development had been, what it was he needed Will to see, he said it was in the trunk and that I'd have to wait until we got to the CPH to see for myself. What about my flight? I asked as we idled at a red light at Leeson Street Bridge. Do I book that or...
We can do that for you. I'll get someone at the station to do it. When do you want to go back?
Well, I suppose now it'll have to be tomorrow.
I'll take care of it.
Does anyone know I'm here? I asked.
We've kept knowledge of your involvement to as small a group as we possibly can. We don't want the press getting wind of it.
Malone glanced at me.
Why? Did something happen?
I was thinking of the hotel room door and the man in the red baseball cap looking up at my window. But what had happened, really?
I'd called the front desk and told them about the lock, and the receptionist reacted in a way that made me think she heard this kind of thing all the time. The batteries would be replaced by the time I got back.
Nothing had been moved or taken. No big deal. And as for the man in the red baseball cap, well,
so what?
Man in sitting on public bench looking around, shocker. And it might have only seemed like he was looking at my window. He was really too far away for me to be sure. Or maybe he'd just been looking at me because I'd been looking at him.
My parents, I said. I haven't told them I'm here. I wasn't going to when I thought it'd be just for the night. Easier that way. But now I probably should.
Do they still live in Cork?
Actually, no, they live in Bray now.
Bray?
Malone laughed. Bray was a seaside town a little over half an hour's drive away, just over the county border in Wicklow.
You're going to have to call them then. You'll never get away with that.
The lights changed and we moved off.
Where in Bray? Are they near the seafront? I always think that'd be a nice place to live.
I actually don't know. I've never been there.
So they just moved there?
My instinct was to answer yes. Yes, they just moved here, and that's why I hadn't visited yet. If I was having this conversation with anyone else, I wouldn't even consider saying anything different. But Malone already knew the awful secret. He already knew who I was, who I'd loved, what I'd done. There was no point in lying to him. I didn't have to.
I've never been back, I said, to Ireland. This is the first time I've been here in 10 years.
The freedom of this, the weight of my customary conversational caution lifted off my shoulders, made me feel momentarily lightheaded.
How come?
My life is in the Netherlands, I said. I've lived there since I was 19. It's my home now. I'm an only child and both my parents are one of two. So it's not like we've this huge extended family I'm duty-bound to keep up with. And I see my parents like 4 or 5 times a year. They come visit me or we go on holidays together.
But why don't you visit them here?
Because I don't want to be here.
Malone kept his eyes on the road.
Why not?
Because of bad memories. Because of the constant threat of someone realizing who I am and asking me about him. Because every girl I went to school with, it seemed to me, had efficiently done all the things you're supposed to do by now. Get coupled up, buy a house, add to the population, leaving me standing out like some unwanted spinster thumb. Because you weren't allowed to not want those things, only to fail to get them. Because none of this existed in Breda, but my job did. Sal did. My lovely home did. Because there really was no good reason to come back here. Because being from someplace didn't mean you had to automatically like it.
Because he was here, physically and figuratively, and I didn't want to think about him.
But I didn't need to say all that, or even some of it, because mostly the reason I didn't like being here was because I'm embarrassed, I said.
Embarrassed? About what?
About falling for it.
For
Will. For Will's lies, I said.
Alison.
Malone said my name so softly and sympathetically that I felt an abrupt unlocking, a loosening, and I turned toward the passenger window in case tears were coming next. No one ever said my name that way, because I never let anyone know that I needed to hear it.
You were 19. 19. You have absolutely nothing to be embarrassed about. And embarrassment needs an audience. Who's in yours?
Yeah, people remember Will, but that's about it. It's been 10 years. I can tell you, most people don't even remember the victims' names. Unfortunately. Trust me, you really don't need to feel that way.
A pause.
I wish you wouldn't.
We drove the rest of the way to the CPH in silence. I'd been convinced that, in the fading light, the Central Psychiatric Hospital would transform into some sort of stereotypical horror movie-style asylum, a psycho house perched on the hill, only with bars in the windows and tortured screams coming from somewhere inside. But the building where Will was looked no different than your average office block now, because its mostly dark windows and fading light made the grates fixed over the glass harder to see. Will was meeting with his counselor, we were told. We'd have to wait a few minutes. Malone and I sat side by side on grey plastic chairs in the lobby. He went to the vending machine and came back with two steaming plastic cups. Coffee for me, tea for him. We sipped them while we waited. "Where's Shaw?" I asked. "He's not coming this time."
"No." "Does he know about this?
Me being here, seeing Will again?"
"You're only doing what I asked you to, and I'm just doing my job."
I took that as a no.
"Will you get in trouble for this?"
"Trouble?"
Malone laughed softly.
"No."
He had carried a large manila envelope in from the car with "Please do not bend" stamped on it in red. When we sat down, he'd set the envelope on the empty chair on his other side.
"Is that the development?" I said, pointing.
Malone nodded.
"We've got some CCTV images. Luckily, there aren't many cameras in that area, mostly traffic ones which point at the road. There's one mounted above an ATM machine near where Louise Farrington was found, though we figured he'd have to pass if he was on foot, but we found nothing on the night of her murder. Then one of the civilian analysts had an idea. She thought, okay, he avoided it the night of the murders, but he has to be familiar with the area in order to pull this off, so he must go there regularly. She started looking for regulars, but odd ones, like someone who only walks there alone very late at night, and tends to double back the way they came.
And she found someone?
She found a few someones, but our prime candidate is a guy we see in the days after Louise Farrington was found, and both before and after Jennifer Madden was, walking alone along the canal late at night, and, more often than not, doubling back the same way he came.
Couldn't he just have been going to someone's house? I asked.
We're talking about him reappearing minutes later, like he's just walking up and down the banks of the canal.
A loud electronic buzzing noise cut through the air, signaling that the door that led off the lobby was opening. A grumpy-looking security guard appeared and beckoned us with a finger.
"Go time," Malone said, standing up, collecting the manila envelope from the seat beside him.
We took the same route as we had the day before, descending into the harshly lit bowels of the hospital building. There was no way of knowing what time of the day it was outside. When we reached the room, I could see Alec standing in there through the pane of glass in the door, but there was no uniformed guarda.
"I'll be doing the watching this time,"
Malone said when he saw the look on my face.
"You ready?"
"No, not really. But then I wasn't ready yesterday either."
Malone put a hand on my arm and gave it a squeeze. This time I managed not to bolt away. I could feel his touch, a buzzing heat source, through the sleeve of my jacket. I couldn't remember the last time I'd felt something like that. Actually, no, I could. There'd been that thing at Christmas, the dinner in Rotterdam with sales managers from the London office. One of them, Thomas, had said goodbye to me outside the restaurant by catching my right hand with his left and leaning in to kiss me on the cheek. Not the usual air kiss, not a kissing sound made somewhere in the region of the other person's cheek, but an actual kiss. Lips pressed against my skin, the bristles of his stubble rubbing against my cheek. But it was the hand, his fingers squeezing around mine, that really stunned me, surprised me, disassembled me. I'd thought about it for weeks afterwards. He probably didn't even think about it at the time. I felt a sudden desire to throw myself into Malone, to bury my face in his chest, to let him hold me, to let him hold me together. Because it was so utterly exhausting doing it all by myself. So now I did pull away.
"The photos," I said.
Malone opened the envelope and slid out the contents. Several A4-sized glossy photographs. I could only see the shot on top. A grainy image, dark, blown up to the point where, if you focused on any one section of it, you only saw squared pixels in shades of grey. If you looked at it for long enough, an image emerged. A figure in dark clothes walking along a stretch of footpath, wearing a baseball cap. I swallowed. That's him.
That's someone we need to talk to so we can eliminate him from our inquiries.
Isn't that what you guys always say? Doesn't that actually mean yes? Malone smiled.
We just want to talk to him.
And what? You think Will might know him?
If he's the real killer, and Will didn't do it, and the real killer framed Will, then yes.
Malone sighed, acknowledging the astronomical odds of this.
Look, it can't hurt to ask.
But it could. Every moment in that room would hurt. What about the general public? I asked.
We've released them to the press. They should already be on all the online news sites. We're too late for tomorrow morning's papers, but we'll get them in there Tuesday.
There's not much to go on, though, I said, looking at the photo. Even if you knew this man, you'd have a hard time recognizing him from this.
That's one of the traffic cam shots.
Malone shifted through the stack, pulling out one.
We got this from the ATM.
This shot was much better. It hadn't been enlarged as much as the others, so it was easier to collect an impression of the man's features without the intrusion of obvious pixels. It was also in color. He was also looking up, almost directly into the camera, with a hand on the peak of the cap as if adjusting it. He was pale and thin, with reddish hair, and he was wearing what looked like a gold ring on his left hand. Due to the angle of the camera, the shadow thrown by the peak of the cap covered half of his face, but I thought maybe if you knew him, you could identify him. The baseball cap was red. I studied the photo, the face. I wasn't sure if I was imagining I was seeing something, or making myself do it. But I felt a flicker of recognition, a faint one, but it was there. I knew this man from somewhere. I'd met this man before, and he was wearing a red baseball cap, just like the man I'd seen from my hotel room window. The door to the room opened with a clang, and Alex stuck his head out.
Let's get the show on the road, lads, he said. Come on.
Alison, now. Inside the room of buttery yellow walls, there was a marked change in Will's demeanor. His reaction to me was the exact opposite he'd had this morning. This time, he barely reacted to me at all. He was slouched in his chair, his face slack, eyes glazed, arms folded. He looked like he'd just woken up, or been woken up. But he'd been meeting with his counselor, so I knew that couldn't be the case. I looked to Alec, who'd resumed his position against the far wall, but he was looking at his watch. I pulled out the empty chair, sat down, and fanned the photographs across the tabletop between us. With an index finger, I spun the best photo around so that Will would see it the right way up. The Gardaí, I said. They'd like you to take a look at these. Do you recognize this man at all? I said nothing about the fact that I thought I knew the man in the picture, because I didn't have the first clue from where. It was more of a feeling than a fact. But I could picture his face, better than it appeared in these images, looking at me, looking down at me, and smiling. I tried to visualize the background, but there was no detail, only grey, blurry blankness. This is important, Will, I said. Still, he didn't look at the photo. He was staring vacantly into the space over my left shoulder. If you don't want to talk to me, just say so. I'll go.
I'd be happy to, because where I wanted to be right now was somewhere quiet, alone, so I could pick up my memories and shake them, see what might fall out.
Who was the man in the picture? Where had we crossed paths? Had we ever? Or was I just trying to convince myself that I saw something I knew in that image? All the answers felt just beyond reach. If I did know him from somewhere, it must be St. John's, either at the college itself or during the time I was enrolled there. It was unlikely I had met him in the Netherlands. Here he was on CCTV in Dublin, after all,
and I doubted very much that I knew him from my 6 years at an all-girls Catholic secondary school back in Cork. Plus, the camera had picked him up only a couple of blocks from campus. St. John's, or something I did when I was there, had to be the link. Which linked this man on the CCTV, potentially the same man who'd been sitting on that bench across the water, to Will too. You didn't even need Malone's cockamamie theory about the so-called real killer knowing Will. With the exception of lectures, I was nearly always with Will. Not because we did everything together, but because we did almost nothing except be together. So if there was someone who looked familiar to me because we'd known each other or met somewhere during that time, wouldn't Will have known or met him too?
You didn't believe it, Will said. Not at first.
It took me a second to pick up the threads of his thoughts. Not at first, I said. No. It was the day after, Will. I wasn't in my right mind. I was still trying to get my head around the fact that Liz was... I stopped. I wouldn't discuss her with him. There was a line, and she was on the other side of it. I didn't know which way was up. He finally looked at me.
You knew enough to give an interview to a national paper about how it was all a huge mistake, how there was absolutely no way I could have done what they were accusing me of.
And I was wrong too. I'd been so stupid, but also so completely convinced, and desperate to do something to help him, to alleviate the physical pain I thought I could feel in my chest at the thought of Will, my Will, being accused of something so horrific, so unimaginable, that I snuck out of the house to call the news desk of a broadsheet and gave their crime reporter an exclusive interview. Girlfriend stands by canal killer, the headline read, because by the time it went to press, Will had confessed to all 5 murders. He'd actually been doing it while I was on the phone. He'd been talking to Shaw while I'd been telling a stranger about our love. My body burned now with the shame of it. Is that why you thought I'd believe you now? I asked, because I did back then for a minute.
I hoped you would.
He met my eyes.
I didn't do this, Ali. I wish I could, I don't know, find a way to make you feel what I feel, or see into my mind, or, I don't know. I don't know what to do to convince you. I can't seem to prove it to you, so words, telling you is all I have. I know that's not enough for anyone else, but I thought it might be enough for you. I hoped it would be. Hoped for 10 long years, Ali. You know me. You say you knew me past tense, but it's not in the past, because I haven't changed. I haven't been able to change, because I've been locked up in here, away from the world, waking up every morning in a punishment for something I didn't do, that happened when I was 19 years old, and I can't... His voice broke. I can't take this much longer. I can't. His eyes had filled with tears and he looked away, embarrassed. In that moment, it was impossible not to feel sorry for him. I had to remind myself that this was about more than feelings. It was also about cold, hard facts. I asked why now. He turned back to me. What?
Why are you only saying this now? It's been 10 years. Will threw up his hands.
Because who'd believe me? I said I did it. They had, apparently, evidence to convict me, and I listened to my solicitor when he said I should do myself a favor and enter a guilty plea, avoid a trial. He said there was no way in hell we were ever to win it, and my parents...
He swallowed.
My parents agreed with him. It was like they couldn't get me locked away fast enough. I was such an embarrassment to them. And you were gone. So who could I even tell? The people in here? They hear it all the time. It was pointless. So I just gave up. In more ways than one. The first few years here, I don't even remember them, to be honest.
He glanced at Alec. Quieter now, he continued.
Then 2 things happened. The first was last year, when this new guy arrived in the unit, John. He was really, well, he had a lot of problems.
They ended up moving him into high dependency, as far as I know. Anyway, he knew who I was, and it turned out that he was, like, obsessed with true crime, and had read all this stuff on the internet about me and this case. I take it you don't have...
What? Access to the internet?
Will snorted. Ali, we don't even get to pick the TV channels around here.
Right. Okay.
So he tells me that there's this website that says I'm innocent, and has all these, you know, documents and witness statements, and stuff that apparently proves it, or tries to. And he was able to tell me things that I never knew. For instance, you know that blood they found under my desk? Did you know they didn't find it on the first search? That it was during the second?
Under a desk, I said. Easy to miss.
Or easy to plant. There must have been 30 people in and out of that room in between those two searches, at least. Any one of them could have put it there. And the locker with the folder in it. There were loads of prints on that thing that weren't mine, but no fingerprints at all on the combination lock on the locker door. Don't you think that's weird? And apparently, get this, someone sent a letter to the St. John's News claiming to be the killer, talking about how girls should be more careful and not walk home alone and all this creepy stuff. Did you ever hear that? I'm not surprised. No one did. It was just dismissed. A crank, they said. But what if it wasn't? And not only that, but the student reporter who received it passed it on to the Gardaí, and they bloody went and lost it. Did you know that?
The truth was, until yesterday, I'd done all I could to avoid knowing anything. Details were my enemy. They filled in the blanks, coloured in my nightmares. And once you knew one, you could never forget it.
Like the shopping cart.
Hours after Will was charged, I'd flown to the Netherlands and taken refuge in my cousin's house in The Hague. My first few days there, the house was full of whispers. Ella and her husband whispered to each other in the hall while I sat in the living room. They whispered to each other in the kitchen before I came downstairs in the morning. They whispered to each other in bed while I lay awake, unable to sleep, in the room just next door. And sometimes they forgot to whisper, sending shards of horror through the walls.
They think he was following them for weeks before he did it, knocked them out, and then pushed them underwater so they drowned. Her friend, found tangled up in a rusted shopping cart.
They were obsessed with the details of the case, like everyone who'd bought those tabloid newspapers at home. I knew when they perched next to me on the sofa, patted my limbs and said that I could talk to them about anything, any time. What they were really saying was, please tell us more, tell us everything, leave nothing out.
It was a joke, Will was saying now. They made so many mistakes.
What he described sounded more like a few loose threads to me, and inconsequential ones at that. And were they even true? He'd heard about them secondhand, from someone who was receiving psychiatric treatment, and that person had read about them on the internet, if any of this had even happened at all.
What was the other thing? I asked.
The new cases. There really wasn't anything I could do to prove I wasn't the canal killer, but maybe out there somewhere, someone could prove that someone else was, because he was still out there. But who'd bother when they thought he was me, and I'm locked up in here? Then, a few days ago, I hear a report about this girl, Jennifer Madden, on the radio, and everything's the same. St. John's, the canal, a head injury. And the weather report said something about the Patrick's Day parade, so I knew the timing fit as well. I didn't even know there'd been another girl before her until Shaw and that other guy told me that when they came here.
Why would they tell you that?
I don't know. Will shrugged. I asked if there'd been others and they said yes, one other. I think they were trying to humour me, to get me to talk, but I said I'd only talk to you.
Because you thought I'd believe you?
Yeah, but I'd no way of contacting you.
And then what? You get me here, I believe you. What then?
Then, Will said, you help me.
But how?
If I was out there, Ali, out of this place, I could look into these things. I could do something. I can't do anything in here. They're not even letting me watch the news now,
so I don't know what's going on with these new girls. But if you were on my side, maybe you could do those things for me. Maybe you would.
He looked away again. But it turns out you think I did this. So none of it matters, does it?
What difference would it make, Will? Let's say I did find something. Let's say I find that letter. What happens then? It doesn't change the evidence against you, and it doesn't negate the fact that you confessed.
You confessed? I can't...
I sighed, exasperated.
It's not going to change anything. You're not going to get out. So why even bother with this, dragging all this horror back up?
The silence that followed thrummed, like the air in a room where the TV is on mute.
This horror, Will repeated softly. This horror is your past, but it's my present.
He leaned forward. Instinctively, I sat back.
10 years ago, they told me I'd committed 5 murders. They showed me what they said was evidence. They got me to say I did it. And no one, not my friends, not my family, not even you, put their hand up and said, "Wait a second, something's not right here. He can't have done this." Everyone just accepted it. Everyone thought it was the truth, which means there was something in me, something about me, that made people think I could have done this. And now, it's all so long ago, I'm starting to forget things. I'm on medication. It makes you foggy. And what I do remember isn't as clear as it once was. So sometimes I think, could I have done this? Sometimes I wonder.
His voice trembled.
Did I?
The last 2 words hung in the air between us.
I just need to know, Allie, that out there is something real, something tangible that proves I didn't do this. If it exists, I need to know about it. For me. It doesn't even matter whether or not the Gardaí give a shit. I don't think they will. But I need to know. Because the only thing worse than spending the next 50 years in here waiting to die would be spending the next 50 years in here waiting to die and wondering if maybe I deserve it.
I met Will's eyes. He held my gaze. I didn't like what I saw in his face in that moment, what I felt pass between us, because it contradicted everything I thought I knew from